Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 27897, State v. Pratt. Arguing for the petitioner, Daniel Hempe. Arguing for the respondent, Tracy Murakami. Argument on the merits.
Mr. Hempe, my understanding is you've reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and there'll be a light that'll come on with 10 minutes to go in your 30-minute argument, so that'll be your signal that you're beginning to get into your rebuttal time. And Ms. Murakami, you are going to get a warning with 5 minutes to go in your argument. Okay, very good. Well, good morning, counsel. If you're ready to proceed, we'll be beginning today with our petitioner, Mr. Hempe.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. As you know, I'm Dan Hempe. I represent Lloyd Imuakaika Pratt. And initially, I want to note he's present in court today. He's right at the end. And we thank you for your time and attention to this matter. Your Honors, Article 12, Section 7 of the Hawaii Constitution, as interpreted by this court, is supposed to provide broad protections to Native Hawaiian tradition and custom. Indeed, this court has written that the Hawaii State Constitution places an affirmative duty on the state and its agencies to preserve and enforce traditional rights exercised by the descendants of Native Hawaiians. In Hanapi, this court applied those broad protections to the criminal context and set forth a very clear defense of constitutional privilege when Native Hawaiian traditions and customs are practiced on undeveloped land. Following this court's guidance, as set out in Hanapi, Mr. Pratt went to trial and proved that his traditional and customary practices were entitled to constitutional protection under Article 12, Section 7, as discussed by this court in Hanapi. It is uncontested that he proved the three Hanapi factors as clearly laid out by this court. I believe he's the first defendant to have done that since Hanapi was decided. But instead of protecting Mr. Pratt's constitutional rights and following Hanapi, upon his showing of the three Hanapi factors, the lower courts instead chose to modify Hanapi and narrow what are supposed to be broad protections. And then they convicted
him. If I may interrupt you, counsel, is it your understanding that Hanapi said that if the defendant meets the three-prong test, that automatically trumps any state regulation?
That is how Hanapi is written. Now, Hanapi does say that the defendant must show these three factors at a minimum. We contend that that language establishes the bar. The defendant is certainly free to establish more, but at a minimum, if he shows the three factors, at that point, we get to a constitutional privilege. We have shown a constitutional privilege. Hanapi is silent as to what happens next. Hanapi does, however, say it is a defense to criminal cases if there is a constitutional privilege.
But when we go back to Article 12, Section 7, doesn't it also say that the rights are subject to the right of the state to regulate such rights, referring to the customary and traditional rights of Native Hawaiians?
And this is where the rubber meets the road. We have a constitutional right to practice Native Hawaiian traditions and customs, meaning the state's right to regulate. Now, Native Hawaiian Legal Corp has filed an amicus brief. We've mentioned it in our cert petition as well. But if we adopt a position that violating a regulation automatically destroys the constitutional privilege, then by definition, there really is no privilege. In other words, it's fairly circular. If violating a criminal law excludes a defendant from having his constitutional privilege, then there really is no privilege in the criminal law. So something, perhaps, I think what the courts have been struggling with is where you are. What happens next after a defendant shows the privilege? And that's it. Now, we assert that Hanapi was decided correctly. But this court does, one of the issues before the court is, will it amend, will it add to Hanapi?
Counsel, doesn't Hanapi refer to the reasonable exercise of ancient Hawaiian usage and indicate that constitutionally protected Native Hawaiian rights reasonably exercised qualify as a privilege for purposes of enforcing criminal trespass statutes? And does that imply the existence of a further balancing test that would look at the reasonableness of the conduct in relation to the reasonableness of the state's interest?
It does talk about the reasonable exercise of the rights. And with that, I have two points to respond. First of all, prior decisions by this court have already undertaken that balance. And Kalipi, Pele Defense Fund, have already talked about reasonableness is implied when the Native Hawaiian traditions and customs are practiced on undeveloped land. And in that regard, we also get to the analysis of harm. In this case, there was a specific finding that no harm was done. Again, we would say by definition that gets us to reasonableness. However, Hanapi is interesting because we do have the three factors. But again, one of the factors is undeveloped land, and this court has already held that that's what makes these practices reasonable.
So your position is it's presumptively reasonable if it's on undeveloped land?
Correct. That's right, the first response to your question. And the second response is, you know, whether that reasonableness prong is implicit or not in Hanapi, I said it's not entirely clear. You know, we're in a criminal case, and the defendant has a right to due process, which is notice, of course, and an opportunity to be heard. I would assert that the Hanapi does not give the defendant notice that there is a balancing test to determine reasonableness, and it does not give notice that the burden of proof in that balancing test is on the defendant. Indeed, once the Hanapi factors are established, if there is to be any further inquiry, the burden of proof ought to shift to the state.
Mr. Hempe, if you read Hanapi, it doesn't mention a balancing test, and it doesn't mention government regulation. So all it focused on was the burden on the person asserting Article, what is it, 12, Section 7. And aside from setting out the minimal requirements, the three minimal requirements, as the basis for asserting the protection of the privilege, or that the, that the practice was protected under Article 7. It goes on and says that the question also is whether the exercise of a protected right is reasonable. So my question to you is, isn't the burden on the proponent of the Constitution to satisfy not only the three requirements, but also the requirement that the exercise be reasonable? And so the reasonableness requirement does not implicate a balancing test unless that is first satisfied.
Again, I assert that prior cases from this court have said,
Well, the cases you cite, they all say, Pash and Kalipi, all say, well, you have to look at the particular circumstances of the case, at least as far as the future is concerned. So I'm not sure that it establishes, does more than establish standards rather than, as you assert, presumptions.
In Hanapi, the court also noted that in the Hawaiian tradition, cooperation and non-interference with the well-being of others are integral parts of the culture. By definition, it's cooperative and non-interfering. We know also that the other cases have talked about reasonableness, the limitation of allowing these practices on undeveloped land is how we accomplish reasonableness. I don't know, quite frankly, what Mr. Pratt could have done at the trial level to prove this obscure bar, for lack of a better word, of reasonableness.
Mr. Hempe, I'm sorry, I have a real fundamental question here. Throughout the record, it appears that everyone is saying that he was cited for camping without a permit. However, it's my understanding that he was actually cited under subsection 4 of the regulations, which is, it appears to be being in a closed or restricted area. And it appears that there was a stipulation that he was actually in a closed area. The regulations talk about camping being permitted in camping grounds, camping areas, and it appears that those areas are actually quite restricted. It's unclear to me whether he was actually in a closed area, which was actually access was denied in its entirety or not. Was he in a closed area to which the signs were not received in evidence from what I can see? What did the signs say?
I do not remember any evidence of any signs, and it's an interesting question.
He was cited for being in a closed area. The regulation says that the board, the department can set areas which are closed or restricted. If he, and there was a stipulation that he was in a closed area, the record appears to indicate that the area in which he was cited was the area of the hayal. It was, were the hayal totally off limits?
There was no evidence of that, and of course this court can sua sponte.
What does closed area mean? You stipulated that he was in a closed area.
Again, I can tell you that the way the trial went down, everybody, there was history that Mr. Pratt had been in that area before with DLNR's permission and consent and even blessing that he did this. There was a good bit of talk about whether he could have obtained permits, and there was testimony about how long those permits would have allowed him in that spot. Again,
isn't I think camping only permitted in the camping areas? Was this a camping area, or was it a closed area?
I don't believe there's actually evidence in the record that it was closed. So again, if the court finds the state didn't prove it was a closed area, I think that it's certainly within the court's purview to resolve the case that way.
Actually, I'm looking at the stipulated facts filed April 12, 2006. At each of the times that Lloyd Pratt was camping, the Kalalau State Park location where he was camping was a closed area. That's what you stipulated to.
It is also an undeveloped area, and I'm not sure, that's the first time this has been, that's actually issue has been raised in this case. I'm not sure it really affects the Hanafi analysis, which is whether or not there's a constitutional privilege to violate that, but it is an interesting point that maybe he's cited under the wrong regulation. And
if this court adopts a balancing test, do you think that we can take some guidance from cases construing the free exercise of religion?
Yes. And also, I note that when Hanafi was decided, the court talked about several cases in the First Amendment arena. And that is, and those cases had intermediate scrutiny applied. Our expert testified that Mr. Pratt was also exercising his religion while in the valley, and that's actually one of the points we've continued to make in this case, was that we actually think that if the regulation is examined, it should be examined under strict scrutiny as religion, because that was what was going on here, rather than intermediate scrutiny. Which are the First Amendment cases, and certainly rather than a rational basis, which appears to be what the trial court at some point talked about.
You never raised that below, though. I mean, the amicus says the burden of proof on the government should be strict scrutiny or compelling state interest, but you never raised that below.
We raised it in the context of religion repeatedly below. I extensively briefed
with respect to Article 12, you never raised that.
Not with respect to Article 12, no. We raised it under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
And you never raised the intermediate scrutiny standard with respect to Article 7 either.
We talked about it in the ICA. You know, what happened is we kept saying we proved Hanapi, and that's it. After the trial, the court imposed, you know, after the case, we learned of the balancing test, and we began arguing about the burdens of proof. And in the ICA, as we were discussing whether there should be a balancing test, we responded that no, the better
well, the court
change
below,
to Hanapi would be.
I'm sorry. The court below applied the rational basis test.
It would appear the court below simply said there's another element to Hanapi. We have to engage in a balancing test.
And you didn't appeal from that finding or that conclusion.
That was our appeal. We alleged the court erred by expanding on Hanapi and finding that a balancing test was implicit, and that he had noticed that a balancing test was implicit, and that we went into court knowing what we had to prove. So we did appeal that, and then as we get to the issue of, once the court seems to be leaning toward modifying Hanapi or having some second analysis after the right was proven, we then started arguing about, well, what should that be? And that really only started in the ICA.
Mr. Hempe, I know you'd argued about the rule of lenity applying and just the notion that your client didn't understand what he could or couldn't do. Could you expound on how that or the other related principles that you talked about might apply here, where I gather your argument is your client would not have any way of having known prior to engaging in the conduct that whether the conduct would or would not have been prohibited by the criminal law because this balancing test was not clear.
Right. I think that's a very important fact, a very important argument, in fact. If Hanapi is to be expanded on or changed or modified in any way, it's very clear that those new aspects of Hanapi should not be applied to a case that went to trial 6 years ago. That's why we also argued that it was an ex post facto application of law, what the court did. Because to the extent there's any ambiguity at all in this, in Hanapi, those ambiguities are, under the rule of lenity, by law, to be construed in favor of the defendant.
Mr. Hempe, assuming that an appellate court can review conclusions of law de novo, why was Judge Leonard wrong in propounding the theory that the appellate court could look at a stipulation of law de novo?
Because they were stipulations of fact.
Weren't they at least mixed questions of fact and law?
Perhaps. Judge Leonard would improperly overturn a finding of fact without finding that there was no support in the record or that the finding of fact was clearly erroneous. That's the second fact. There's a three-fact test that gets you to the conclusion of law: Native Hawaiian, undeveloped land, traditional and customary practice. Those were found by the district court in its findings of fact to be true. Once those three are met, we get to the then conclusion of law that there's a constitutional privilege. What I assert Judge Leonard attempted to do, because she's in the minority as to that aspect of her opinion, but what I assert that Judge Leonard attempted to do was really she took issue with the second Hanapi fact, which was that it was a traditional and customary practice. She said it wasn't. That was a factual determination that she made. She overturned a fact, which really should have only been overturned if there was no support in the record for that fact. And then once she overturned the fact, she used that as the basis to change the conclusion of law.
Oh, so you don't necessarily have a problem with an appellate court looking at a stipulated conclusion of law. It's just that you feel that a stipulated fact shouldn't be overturned if there is substantial evidence to support it.
Right. We put on proof of all three facts.
Right.
And then the state stipulated to all three facts. And so, yes, absent an abuse of discretion, I believe it is, or no support in the record at all for those facts, that would be improper for the appellate court to overturn those facts. And then once Judge Leonard overturned one of the facts, she used that as the basis to reverse a conclusion of law drawn therefrom. I also note in Judge Leonard's opinion that she found that Mr. Pratt had set up a seasonal residence, that he was essentially residing there, while simultaneously ruling that he didn't have a right to be there because he didn't reside there.
Well, you just told us that we could sua sponte decide a particular fact here. I mean, in argument just a few minutes ago.
Well, I should clarify. What I meant to say is, as the court knows, you can sua sponte reverse plain error, and I was maybe I'm misinterpreting Justice McKenna's questions, but I was thinking she was getting at saying there was no proof of it being a closed area, perhaps the entire conviction.
You know, in Hanapi, Justice Klein did exactly what Judge Leonard did. He set out the test, and then he looked at the second factor, and he said the evidence is not sufficient for the second factor. And he did that on appeal.
Well, he agreed with the trial court that there was insufficient evidence. In this case, the trial court held that there was sufficient evidence.
But he examined what the evidence was in support of the second factor.
They did examine the evidence, but again, they simply affirmed the trial court's finding that it was insufficient. In this case, we have the opposite. The court reversed the trial court's finding. Your Honor, my yellow light is on. May I reserve the balance?
You may, for okay. Rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hempe. Ms. Murakami, your argument?
Mr. Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court, may it please the Court, Tracy Murakami, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney for the County of Kauai, representing Respondent, State of Hawaii. When this Court accepted certiorari, I was disappointed, and not because I didn't want to come here, but to me, the factual issues in this case were not fleshed out sufficiently. Justice McKenna brought up, it's a foundational factual issue, a fundamental factual issue. Where exactly was he? Where is the delineated campgrounds? Is the entire valley closed, or it's the summer months? Do we presume in the summer months? Because traditionally the DLNR grants permits for camping at the shoreline during the summer months. He's in the valley. These issues were not fleshed out. And
you actually stipulated that this was a closed area, correct?
Correct.
And that was a finding of the trial judge, that this was a closed area.
Correct.
But and a closed area under the regulation is defined as a place that is off limits, basically, right?
That's correct.
So in other words, a native Hawaiian kahu cannot go to the heiau, correct?
Well, see, in this record, it's unclear.
Under the regulation, the heiau is off limits, correct?
Camping near the heiau is off limits.
The regulation says the closed area is off limits, correct?
And that's the issue that I'm raising, that this record wasn't very well developed. And obviously, the state is to blame, you know, at least partially for that. So when the state steps back and looks at this, what are the issues, the main issues? One of them is, how closely do we scrutinize the defendant's actions? In this case, petitioner is there for the primary purpose of engaging in Native Hawaiian traditional and customary practices. But then there are ancillary actions, which are setting up the residence. And so it's unclear whether in categorizing his actions, planting a garden, planting bananas, planting coconut, clearing out litter.
But he was not cited for any of these activities, correct? This
correct.
Is a criminal case. He
correct.
Was cited for being in a closed area.
Correct.
And he was not cited for camping. There is a separate camping regulation, subsection 14. He was cited for being in a closed area.
Correct. And so the state's understanding in the usual use of Kalalau Valley is that in the area where he was is open to hiking. It's not that you cannot step foot in that area. But again, this isn't fleshed out in the record, which is part of the problem here. So
it's not fleshed out in the record, then you lose, right? You have the burden of proof. If it's not fleshed out in the record's ambiguous, we're not really sure, you know, whether he was properly cited, then you lose, don't you?
Correct, and correct.
So
that's right.
You're conceding in this case?
The state is not here to be let out of any of its concessions that it made before the lower court. The state is here to advocate for the right of the state to impose reasonable regulations.
Yeah, but what about this case? If this case is so unclear, then you haven't carried your burden of proof. Isn't that true?
Well, it's the defendant's burden to establish the constitutional criminal defense in this case.
I'm not sure why you're arguing about the house lot and the bananas, et cetera, because you conceded to that.
Correct. I guess this court is going to, I assume, issue a published decision for further guidance to the people of Hawaii for the future. And one of the things in looking at this that I thought was a little confusing was there are two classes of activities he's engaged in, and one is setting up the residence, and one is the restoration of Heiau. And within those two classes of activities, or two general categories of activities, are more specific activities. And so one of the questions that's raised is everything constitutionally protected that he's doing in the valley, where the primary purpose is to engage in Native Hawaiian and traditional practices? For example, on Kauai, we have this very strange practice where the DLNR does not enforce driving on the beach. When I go to the beach with my children, I literally tell them to watch out for the cars driving on the beach. So someone could argue that they're driving on the beach to go fishing. So then the question is, if the act of fishing is constitutionally protected, is the act of driving included in the scope of protection? And
Is that issue before this court at
no,
this time?
It's not, but I think it illustrates this case will be applied, or people will use it in the future to guide their decisions. And so that's one of the issues that appears to the state that
I'm not sure if the record, I'm just speaking, for my point of view, that the record is so clear that this case can be used as precedent. But are you disagreeing with Judge Leonard, who went behind, since you conceded mm-hmm. the three factors, who looked at the three factors based on the court's power mm-hmm. to look at constitutional questions independently? Are you disagreeing with her position?
I'm not disagreeing that the appellate courts have the power to do that. But I'm certainly not going to advocate to be let out of a concession that the state made before the lower court.
Do you agree that the court can independently look at a constitutional question and decide that without respect to how the trial court decided that?
I think that the appellate courts typically do that, and if they do it, it favors the defendant. I think that the problem in this case is that we'll favor the state. And so I think it raises another issue of due process. Does the defendant have a due process right to hold the state to a concession that it made before the lower court?
You know, well, you're held to that concession, but is the court held to that concession?
I don't believe that the court is, no. No. And Mr. Hempe raised the issue of it's ultimately a legal issue. But I think the reason it was overturned were based on facts. It's a mixed issue of law and fact. And that's his discomfort in this case. So the other issue that the state is here to, I guess, advocate for is in looking at the state's ability to reasonably regulate, Chief Judge Nakamura required a showing of actual harm. And I know there's three different quotes from Kalipi on pages 10 through 12 that use the phrase actual harm. And it's ambiguous. Does actual harm mean, you know, literally harm that already occurred? And I think if this court adopts the interpretation that actual harm means harm that already occurred, then the state could actually never regulate prospectively, because we couldn't do it until we prove that the harm had already occurred.
Well, if we accept that argument, counsel, what would your answer be to Mr. Hempe's question of what could Mr. Pratt have done to establish reasonableness in this case?
Well,
if it's not actual harm, then what is it? What should he have done? What should he have come forward with in the state's view?
You know, on one extreme, we had Chief Judge Nakamura's construct of showing prior harm. And on the other hand, we had the district court saying, well, this is what Mr. Pratt did, but we need to consider what would happen if other people did what he did. And I actually don't think either formulation is correct. I think the test should be, what are the reasonable impacts of the conduct with which defendant is charged? So in this case, the defendant made the prima facie showing under, you know, the first three parts, and then the question really of the balancing of interest, you know, the state would have to show what the reasonably foreseeable impacts of his actions are.
So that would be the state's burden.
Well, the hard part about burden and the balancing test is we don't even get to part four until the defendant established one through three. So,
which you conceded he did.
Correct.
So assuming we go with that concession, we're now looking at part four, the state would have the burden of showing it in your view?
No, I think in talking about a balancing test, burden is inaccurate. It's imprecise.
Counsel?
Yes.
Do you also think that if we do reach a balancing test, wouldn't the Native Hawaiian religion's practices also be construed under other cases construing free exercise of religion? And under those cases, isn't the law that where there is a showing that the law burdens the practice of a religious belief, the state must show an overriding or compelling secular reason for not granting an exemption from that law?
And again, the regulation in this case is being in a closed area. Again, this is where it gets difficult, because my understanding is being in that area is not prohibited. It's the camping in the area that's prohibited. So the question is, does this regulation...
Is that what... This is a criminal case. That's not what he was cited with, correct?
Being in a... It's being in a closed area, but the DLNR doesn't actually close it to... It's not actually utterly closed.
If that's in the record, or that's just your personal knowledge, counsel? Is there anything in the record that would help us
understand? I understand. And again, this is why this case is somewhat problematic. Because if you read the record, the impression you are left with, it is completely closed. That's the impression.
So that is the record, and that's how we should decide the case, based on that assumption or that state of the record?
Again, but it's the state, that's the state's concern, is that some of these issues were not fleshed out as carefully as they should have been.
Well, you cited under a specific regulation. The regulation says not close all the time, but close for the period set forth on the sign.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I can't understand what your position is. If you cited under that, then that ordinance or that rule doesn't say close all the time. It says close at certain times as posted on the signs.
Mm-hmm.
So what's your position? I'm not sure exactly then, you know, what you're arguing.
I guess my
seem to be arguing against your position.
Well, the state's concern is that the record doesn't accurately reflect the DLNR's regulation of the valley. They're actually how they regulate this during the summer months when there is camping. You don't get, the facts are not clear.
So you're introducing facts that are not in the record in your argument?
Your Honor, I'm sorry, this is why this case is difficult for the state.
You know, Justice McKenna talked about the burden on the state being a compelling state interest. And how do you respond to that? Because that's what Amica says too. The court, obviously below, didn't apply compelling state interest as a burden on the state to support this regulation.
The state believes the regulation should be subject to rational basis review because the regulation itself doesn't prohibit the activities. What's prohibited, what he was citing with was, and the citations themselves say he was camping in the area in violation of this section, which is entitled closing of areas.
So the sign said camping?
I'm sorry, the citation. The citation.
The citation cites the regulation. The regulation cites the sign. What did the sign say?
That's not in the record, Your Honor. My understanding is not in the record.
Well, you stipulated it was actually a closed area. And there's a distinction in the regulation between closed areas and restricted areas, correct?
Correct.
You know, even assuming that this was a camping type of case, the law also prohibits regulations that impose a substantial burden on the practice of a religion, correct?
Correct.
There is a charge for camping permits, correct?
That's correct.
For Kama'ainas?
That's
correct. Not in the record, but it's...
It's not.
It's not a meager sum of money for 5 days, is that correct?
And in hindsight, we should have introduced, or we should have expanded on the evidence regarding the curatorship program, whether fees would be waived or not.
And it's also the court's understanding, isn't it true generally known that the number of camping permits is actually limited?
Absolutely.
So there's no guarantee that a Native Hawaiian seeking to visit Kalalau would be able to receive a permit, correct?
And I think that's why Mr. Souza from DLNR talked about the curatorship program. It's distinct from the traditional permitting process. And again, we should have developed that more. Is there a limitation? Because the permit system has a limitation on length of stay.
Do you agree with Judge Leonard's analysis?
Which part, Your Honor?
The part that goes behind the three factors and looks at the facts and applies the law, which he says is case law, to those facts.
You mean in undoing the second part? Is that?
Yeah. Well, at least the second part.
I think her discomfort is the state's discomfort now. The state conceded that, and this is in the post-hearing memorandum of law, the state conceded that the petitioner was engaged in Native Hawaiian traditional cultural practices while in Kalalau Valley. That's the concession. So what is unclear, and again, the state didn't cross the field from this, is what was the scope of the state's concession? Were some of his activities protected? Was that the concession? Or all of his activities? Was that the concession? And I think the district court took that to mean all of his activities. That's how the district court construed that. And so I think that Judge Leonard is uncomfortable with saying all of these activities are constitutionally protected. Setting up a residence. I mean, her discomfort is literally setting up a residence in a state park. So in closing, the state has a reasonable right or has a right to reasonably regulate the Native Hawaiian culture and traditional practices that is right in Article 12, Section 7. And
how do you square that with the contention that this is a religious practice? No, this is a regulation that operates not directly on religion. So what is the burden then? I mean, it's not a statute that specifically applies to religious practice, but just generally to everyone. Is the burden different? What would the standard be that we would have to apply?
I think you have to look at whether the charged conduct, you know, is he prohibited from engaging in his in the practice of religion? Does the charged conduct prohibit him from doing that? And again, it's unclear whether could he go to the heiau, or was that actually prohibited by the regulation? Does the right to engage in your religion include the right to reside near the heiau? And that's why I think this case, a lot of this case, is about how broadly the various activities are construed as protected, especially when you have multiple activities in which a criminal defendant is engaged in.
But the activity he was cited for was his mere presence, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And the ordinance or the regulation said he had no right to be present, period, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And does the state concede that applying the factors, the factors that we've discussed here today, that such a blanket prohibition is unsustainable?
Yes. And again, the problem is that is not the state's understanding of how DLNR regulates this. The other thing that's not in the record at all, to my understanding, is the burden on petitioner of residing in the campgrounds and going to the heiau during the day. What was that burden? That's not in the record.
There's no evidence as to the distances.
No, there's not. There's not.
Do you wish to wrap up your argument further?
The state obviously is here to advocate for the DLNR's right to impose reasonable regulations on everybody within its parks. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Murakami. Mr. Hempe, any rebuttal?
Yes, thank you, Chief Justice. Your Honor, in rebuttal, first I want to highlight all the cases on religion for decades say that if a regulation, a neutral regulation, an otherwise neutral regulation, has the effect of substantially burdening religion, then the burden shifts to the government to show that the regulation at issue is narrowly tailored to accommodate the right.
Mr. Hempe, did you bring this up as a point of error in your certiorari?
I brought it up in our opening brief in the ICA.
Did you bring it up on the writ that you filed here? I believe that you only had two questions, and one was you were concerned about the concession by the state, and the other was the defense under Article 12, Section 7, and the reasonableness of the conduct.
We brought up that the regulation should be should pass constitutional scrutiny. We brought it up in the cert petition on the basis of his traditional and customary rights. We've brought it up throughout the case also on the basis of religion. We assert that the test, however, is the same. And so before we even get to a balancing test, should this court impose one, I assert that the court should first examine the regulation at issue. And this, on this record, the regulation at issue would blanketly prohibit his conduct. There is nothing in this record to show that the regulation at issue does anything to accommodate the constitutional right when the mandates from this court have been sent down repeatedly that it is the job of the courts to protect the constitutional right. This regulation isn't tailored to protect the right at all, let alone narrowly tailored to protect the right. And that is what is mandated, that this culture be protected. Nothing in this record shows anything about accommodation. And if violating a reg by doing a traditional and customary practice when the regulation has no mechanism to accommodate the rights can result in criminal sanctions, we assert that there's something fundamentally wrong, that the right, in fact, has no meat. It goes further. In PASH, this court actually talked about the Hawaiians having a specific right. The PASH court said, a Hawaiian who has exercised such rights on undeveloped lands has an interest that is clearly distinguishable from that of the general public. So it's a constitutional right, and again, we contend that before criminal sanctions are imposed for violating a regulation, that at a minimum, the regulation should be examined to see whether it affords any protections, more specifically, whether it is narrowly tailored to fully protect that right to the extent feasible.
We have a provision in our Constitution, and there is one in the U.S. Constitution protecting the right of free religion. But you never raised that, right?
Well, again, we raised religion throughout the case. We assert
you never raised any specific article in the U.S. Constitution or in the Hawaii Constitution with respect to religion.
We've asserted all along that the two fundamental constitutional rights that are at issue here, religion and traditional customary practices,
I'm sorry,
result in the same test.
My question was, Mr. Hemphy,
all right.
Did you cite any specific article in the U.S. Constitution or in the Hawaii Constitution having to do with religion?
No, we cited the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which was passed specifically to give life to the First Amendment protections
of religion.
And
therefore, the district court never ruled on that question.
The district court actually ruled that Mr. Pratt did not establish that his conduct was entitled to. I can get you the exact finding.
I think the district court did agree with you that there was established proof of a customary and traditional Hawaiian practice.
Yes.
But said that, I guess, the state regulation weighed more heavily in its opinion.
Right, and the district court really dismissed, just really did away with the religion argument. Frankly, I remember thinking, wow, that's all we got. He just ruled that I forget his exact language at this moment, but Mr. Pratt did not prove that his activities were entitled to protection as religious activities, something to effect in the findings of fact.
But the case law does include Native Hawaiian religious practices within traditional and customary practices, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Religion is one of the practices, thank you, Your Honor, that is protected under traditional and customary practices. It's right in there. So that's our point. We thought it was sort of subsumed in that. Because it's all really part of the same package. It's his religion, it's his rights.
What article would that be?
That's Article 12, Section 7, I believe,
and
as interpreted by this court.
Sorry. Go ahead.
No,
And so Hanapi sets out the tests that we would apply to Article 7.
Correct. And so again, I'm saying before we even get to a balancing test, if we get to a balancing test, we should first examine the regulation at issue. But finally, and I want to conclude because we are here now with the two courts saying there's a balancing test implied. And if that is to be done, we'd ask the court for guidance on that, you know, how it is to be done. What weight is to be given to whether or not Mr. Pratt did any harm? Because right now, the only thing against Mr. Pratt in the balance, is that he violated the regulation. The record is very clear. When he was in the valley, he cleared invasive species, he restored the heiau, he planted native plants. I mean, he did nothing but good. And that's why this is so troubling that conduct was ultimately criminalized. So how is the balancing test to be applied? Who has the burden of proof? And what weight do we give to the question of whether or not the defendant actually did any harm? And finally, I just close by highlighting again on the rule of lenity. But this court, the Hawaii State and this court have granted the defendant a privilege. One defendant, as far as we know, since Hanapi, has gone to court and proved the facts that get him to that privilege. The result of that should be an acquittal. It should not be telling him after the fact that we've now just raised the bar for you and we are going to convict you based on additional tests that were not particularly clear or available to you at the time of trial. So I thank you, Your Honor, for your time, and I hope the court takes this opportunity to really affirm the broad protections that are given to traditional and customary rights, affirm Hanapi, and instruct the lower courts to follow it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, counsel. The court will take this matter under advisement.